When I first met Tim Leary and hung around with him and found out, then this was before I ever took any, I never took any legal drugs, like cigarettes or alcohol, or I did in 1964 have some coffee, but this was in a social situation. And I was experimenting, careless youth. I mean, I heard some of the other people talk about caffeine. I just wanted to try it for myself. It was, that stage we were going through there. And I remember Tim was going to go on some program. It might have been Meet the Press. And he was in the green room backstage pacing, and he had this envelope behind him like this, and he was walking back and forth. It turned out that he was wearing his white guru uniform, and it had a rip in the pants, and he wasn't wearing any underwear. So I'd like to introduce to you one of the most powerful trendsetters of our time, my friend and associate Tim Leary.
Thank you, Paul. I want to say a word beginning about a man that I admire very much and is not as well known as he should be. The man who's brought us all together here tonight, Oz Janiger. I go way back with Oz Janiger. I think it was 1962, Richard, that we were doing our research at Harvard, and word came to us that, hey, you're just new kids on the block. The real stuff is happening out in Los Angeles, where there's a wizard named Oz. He's very cool and laid back, and you don't see him on the Johnny Carson show, but he's performing very interesting research. So the first time I came out here, I immediately called Oz, and in his courtly and generous fashion, he invited me over to his clinic. And I want to tell you, that made our Harvard research look like an East Coast version of a Los Angeles performance. I mean, he had over 100 cases of artists that had painted, and then they painted before and after, and it was just there's no research that I know of in psychedelic history that can come close to what Oz did, and it's the only research perhaps in the history of psychology, goes back to Wundt and Fechner, that a psychologist had his research protocols and data shown in a popular art festival. So not only did he have the stuff to look at, but Oscar had questionnaires and tests, and it was Oz was not trained basically as a scientist, and yet it was top hardball major league science, and that's one of the reasons why we're all here tonight. Then that evening, I went over to Oz's house, and he took me into his study or his library. And again, I felt a little embarrassed coming from Harvard, because Oz had then, this is 26 years ago, probably the finest collection of privately held collection of books and manuscripts on the drug experience, altered states of consciousness experiences. It was better than the Harvard Library, which is not saying that much, because Harvard Library did not specialize in. So I can testify before you tonight, brothers and sisters, that Oz Janiger comes before us with this proposal to start a library and an archive and a place where we can reserve and collect and access this valuable information. He's been at it a long time, and I'm totally with you, Oscar. You can count on my support in this wonderful cause. Which brings me to the first point I wanted to make. When I arrived here today, Oscar took me aside with that uncle look that he's often given me and said, now, Timothy, when you give your talk tonight, remember, this is a legitimate organization. I said, yeah, Oscar, I know it, and you can count on me. There, in fact, I was going to break the news to Oscar that I'd hope you're not counting on anything colorful for me tonight because you think I'm crazy, you think I'm going to get in front of 1,000 people in 1988 when Reagan's still in the White House and Meese is still running the Justice Department and rave about LSD. Not to mention mushrooms, mescaline, marijuana, and ibogaine. And if I had Terrence McKenna here tonight, well, I could go on for 5 minutes. No, Oscar, you know and I know, we all know that I stopped talking about LSD in 1970 for good reasons. One is getting boring. Number two is no longer the time for those breathless commercials. And number three, I was getting ready to go to jail. But I was not the only one to stop. We all stopped. As a matter of fact, to become 69 and 70, if someone came up to you at a party or like that and said, wanted you to explain what LSD was, I remember we'd say, well, it's too late. If you don't know by 1969, you know, the world's round, too. You know about that? Anyway, yeah. Anyway, yeah. However, there was a time, I want to tell you, there was a glorious time in this country when a lot of people were talking about psychedelic experiences and drugs like mescaline, peyote, and LSD. I would say this period probably was 1955 to 1970. When you think of the people, the brilliant, talented, wise men and women who were talking at the top of their lungs about LSD between 55 and 70, we have to go back, of course, to the father of us all, that wonderful, wonderful wizard in Basel, Switzerland, Albert Hofmann. He was writing reports that had never come out of a Sandoz laboratory before. Another person that talked about psychedelics in those days was an amazing person, Robert Gordon Wasson. He's your ultimate Square Morgan Guarantee Trust banker. He had the advantage of having a Russian wife, and which is one step to the future, apparently. Robert Gordon Wasson wrote books, magazine articles, and even a big spread in Time Life magazine, in which he described his mushroom experiments in Mexico with Maria Sabrina with such prose, such eloquence, such poetry, such inspiration. Listen, in my wildest Irish blarney moment, I never came within 10 miles of Wasson. How about Laura? How about our dearest friend in the world, Aldous Huxley? Those books, The Doors to Perception, Heaven and Hell, and then that wonderful book, Island, the way Aldous would describe his first mescaline experience, and he was comparing what he saw on the tablecloth with the drapery paintings of Giotto and Titian. I mean, boy, few people have conveyed the power and the wonder of the inner voyage or the brain turned on as Aldous did. Then there was another person that is right up in my all-time Hall of Fame of MVPs, that's Most Valuable Philosophers, and I know Laura and Ralph and Richard, everyone will agree with me, Alan Watts. The influence of Alan Watts simply cannot be exaggerated. You can't estimate it because year after year, from the age of 19 when he wrote that first book on Buddhism, he was busy in person, in small groups, in radio shows, television. I've never met anyone that could take the ineffable and make it funny and very English convincing as Alan. He sure did a lot of talking. Alan Ginsberg came to Harvard, and we were pretty square psychologists, and Alan said, "Listen, boys, this has been going on for 5,000 years, and it's been going on in England, it's going on in France with Hashishins, it's going on in Greenwich Village right now with the Beatnik poets." And so we signed up for the Allen Ginsberg 101 tour of the inner voyage. There were a lot of people talking up in Canada. There was Humphrey Osman, who coined the word psychedelic, another gifted scientist and an eloquent spokesperson. How about Ken Kesey and his group in San Francisco? Have to mention, of course, people that conveyed the mystery and the power and the grandeur and the long traditional scope of what we were involved in, the great bards and minstrels and musicians. How about the Beatles and Bob Dylan? Ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more, are we? Now, 20 years later, they finally popped up in Russia. You know what glasnost and perestroika mean in you translate it in English? That's the summer of love stuff. Glasnost means, mellow out, and perestroika means, drop out. I get a little irritated when this upstart, impertinent Russian Gorbachev trying to claim the credit for stuff that, Bob Dylan said, "We ain't going to work on Brezhnev's agricultural commune no more, are we?" I know I've left out many names that I should mention in this list of people who spoke out convincingly. Notice that I've tended to limit myself to people who are in the business professionally of dealing with ideas, performing philosophers, writing philosophers, psychiatrists, minstrels, bards, poets, novelists. We tended to get more visible publicity because that's our business. We're in the business of transmitting ideas. But I'd like to ask you to join me in heartfelt tribute to about 7 million Americans who took this trip between 1955 and 1970, who saw what we saw, and who know what we know, that there's a glorious wonder behind the forehead. So to them, our strong, ever-present, pervasive, and less noisy friends, great tribute to them. This is a very sentimental moment for me and for Richard and Ralph. It is, as Ralph pointed out, the first time we've been together, actually, in almost 25 years. We've spent a lot of time with each other, but never à toi. And I have such accurate, precise, valid, magnificent memories of those many and wonderful years at Harvard. I cite you the case of Richard Alpert Ram Dass. I am sincere, and I'm not being lavish when I tell you that he is going to be seen as one of the great American philosophers. And more than just what philosopher meant in the old days, philosopher meant, under feudalism, philosophy, was not performed. Philosophy was enforced. And when Moses came down the mountain with those marble tablets, those are not suggestions, boys and girls, And in the industrial age out of which we're now coming, the philosopher is someone who's up there in the ivory tower, and you taught philosophy, meaning the philosophy of the past. But Richard Alpert was a performing philosopher. The saga of Richard Alpert which he's told about many times in satire and humility, is really glorious of how he came from Newton, Massachusetts as a very dutifully middle-class person, and step by step changed and mutated, and the courage and the recklessness. You think I've been reckless. Things that Richard will go anywhere for an illumination or a revelation, and I just have stood in the sidelines with great admiration watching Richard. And I want to tell you something about Richard. When I've seen him recently in the last 2 or 3 years, I didn't see him for about 7 or 8 years when I was having a little trouble with the government, but he is a good-looking man. You know what I mean? And in a sense of, Richard always had a voice. The first time I met Richard Alpert, I knew we were going to make a lot of trouble together. He came bounding my office at Harvard, and he had this boyish appearance, and he was gung-ho for any interesting thing. So Richard and I made a partnership, partners in time, I like to say. But now, when I look in Richard's eyes, there's a very strong, wise, solid man there. I mean, he looks like a football coach, you know? And I say that in the best sense of the word, of a man I'm proud to be your friend, Richard, and look forward to many years ahead, better and better. Now, Ralph Metzler is another hero. When I first met Ralph, he came into our office at Harvard and said he wanted to volunteer for this dread drug research, and Ralph had come from England, where he was a top student in the English public school system, and he was smarter than most of the American-trained graduate students. But he was so precise, and he was so British, and I thought, oh my God, can I take this young man into the maximum security prison and like that? Well, I want to tell you that, again, when you talk about courage and risk-taking and the ability to put yourself on the front line and your body and your reputation and your mind and even your soul, I've watched the saga. Now, Ralph just told you tonight that here's this very, very experimental psychologist who in 10 years is the leading top exponents of the psychedelic experience, and then he stopped for 9 years. Now, that's interesting. And then in the last, 8 or 9 years, Ralph has moved ahead and has done something that's very valuable and necessary. He's our historian. You heard him in action tonight. And he's also made us acquainted with the history of where we all came from, the shamanic tradition, the voodoo tradition, the Celtic, the German traditions. And again, did you notice, I was saying to Richards, we were watching Ralph on the podium here tonight, you know, he could be a movie star, you know? He's like the Redford mustache and all that. I mean, yeah. So I'm proud to be part of this trio. It was not a trio. I apologize for that. There were many of us there. At one time, or overall, there were must have been 50 people in our project at Harvard. And I want to tell you, I don't think I'd put us up against the 1927 New York Yankees. Or Plato, Aristotle, I'd meet in fair contest. That was a hell of a group of thinkers. Down the street, down Mass Avenue, there was a college called MIT, and the chairman of the philosophy department at MIT was a man named Houston Smith, who was hanging out. Actually, he brought Aldous Huxley there to, remember, Laura, when Aldous was the visiting professor there? And he came over to Harvard and said to Richard and Ralph, and I, listen, I'd like to have some psilocybin. You know, well, man, what do you mean? You're coming in here, you want to score? What's going on? What do you want to do with it? I teach the graduate course on mysticism at MIT, and I'd like to have some laboratory demonstrations. And in due course, he worked with us, we trained him, and he went back to MIT. And believe it or not, I know in the 1988, it sounds as though I'm hallucinating when I say this, but he was giving psychedelic drugs as part of a required course at MIT. And is it a dream? Is it a dream? Or Walter Houston Clark, who was an emeritus professor in his 60s, came into our office and he wanted to take a trip. Oh, my God. turned out that for the next 20 years, he's now in his 80s, he's been the most gung-ho, acrobatic, psychedelic, visionary. He became the president of the American Psychological Association's religious, so forth. He's, the heroism of and the courage of these men to take this position and stick by it year after year. George Litwin and Gunther Weil. I could go down the list of the people that were there with us at Harvard. I'm very proud, and I know Richard shares this pride with me. Ralph doesn't, because he was a graduate student. But as faculty members, I think Richard and I can say that of the 20 or 25 students that were working with us, maybe only one of them ever got tenure. Not one of them went on the old assembly line and they got on that thing of assistant professor and associate professor. I mean, I'm so proud of each one of our graduate students, matter of fact, has become Nancy Reagan's number one advisor on the war on drugs. So, do your thing, man. The interesting thing was, at that time, between 55 and 70, and certainly between 60 and 68, when we were busy doing our work, there were at least 50 other research projects and small groups that were working together in this frontier. Now, I can't speak for all of them, but I can speak for our group at Harvard. There were at least two things that we knew right from the beginning. Number one was that we didn't know what we were doing. There was simply nothing in American psychology or American science or American philosophy that could prepare the American in 1960s for a full-blown, full-tilt boogie, a psychedelic experience. It was hallucination or a psychotomimetic or a schizophrenic, and literally most of the academics thought we were out of our minds encouraging people or allowing them to go out of their minds. And there was no language, there was no tradition. And that's where people like Aldous Huxley and Gerald Hurd and Humphrey Osmond and Alan Watts came in. They sat down with us very quietly. You know, they took us into the drawing room like fathers and uncles with young kids, and they said, listen, boys, this has been going on for thousands of years. As a matter of fact, if you trace the philosophic history of the human race, you'll find that in every culture, and particularly any culture that has lasted or that gave our species a message or a cargo of interesting philosophy, you will always find this tradition of the transcendental experience or the mystery cult. Or Ralph, of course, who knows much more about this than I, will tell you about Eleusis, and the origins of most of the great religions go back to groups of people who made this discovery that you don't look for God or you don't look for power in the Caesars or in the temples or in the churches and all that. You look within. They fired Emerson from Harvard, by the way, for saying that in around 1838. He said self-reliance, which of course means drop out. They wouldn't let Emerson back to Harvard for 38 years, and after all, Richard and I came back after 20 years, so it shows that something's loosening up. We knew, number one, that we didn't know what we were doing. We knew, number two, that we were onto something that was bigger than both of us, bigger than all of us, and we felt, as I know most of you in this wonderful scene tonight feel, that we have been, and we are, and we shall continue to be part of one of the glorious traditions of human spirit. We're Homo sapiens sapiens. It's our job. We're the animals or the entities that are wired, fired, and inspired and given this 100 billion neuron brain to think and to explore. The fun has hardly begun. The fun has hardly begun. See, we knew by the mid-60s, all of us, by the way, were taken totally by surprise with the baby boom. You know, we didn't realize that when Dr. Spock told kids that to demand feeding, that they'd want demand breeding, and they'd want to have some say of their education and their sex lives, and they'd want something better than alcohol. So by the mid-60s, we realized that it was going to take at least 20, maybe 25 years before the seeds that we were planting or the work we were starting would become cohesive as an intellectual, as in a scientific, as a linguistic entity, and above all, as a social-cultural situation. I have a lot of fun these days talking. It's an election year, and people ask about what's going on and so forth, and I look into the camera, or I look at the reporter, and I say, well, I have a very simple and obvious common sense statistical fact that I think is going to change a lot of things. 10 years from now, in the year 1998, over 75% of the House of Representatives and probably 66% of the High Court will have been Bob Dylan fans 30 years before. Thank you and good night.
Thank you, Tim. For a moment there, when you were describing how handsome Ram Dass and Ralph Metzner were, I thought you were coming out of the closet. I hardly know how to introduce our next speaker because he's kept changing his name. I remember they used to, at the beginning, they would say, and now we have Richard Alpert. Then they had to say, now we have Baba Ram Dass, formerly Richard Alpert. And then he was going to go back to Richard Alpert, so we were going to say, now I'd like to introduce Richard Alpert, formerly Baba Ram Dass. Or we could just skip the middle and say, here's Richard Alpert, formerly Richard Alpert. But I just know that meeting these people at Millbrook, for me, made me realize that even if there was brain damage, it was worth the risk. And one time I asked Ram Dass if we exchanged our philosophies, that if I believed in reincarnation and he didn't believe in reincarnation, how would that change our behavior? And he thought for a split second and said, well, if you believed in reincarnation, you wouldn't ask a question like that. And it was sort of like a Zen koan. But it was Laura Huxley who persuaded him to drop the robes and just to wear a casual sweater and to drop the baba. So I'm honored and delighted to introduce just plain Ram Dass.
Good evening. And it is a good evening. This is a very precious evening. Just the way in which we are out front in honoring something that's played such an important part in our lives. And it's interesting, so often people say to me, well, you have stopped using drugs, haven't you? And I always say, no, I haven't. In fact, I take acid every couple of years to find out what I've forgotten. When Paul was talking about being in court on acid, it brought to mind a moment when, for many years, I was plagued with the problem of coming down all the time. And since I was I was Mr. LSD Junior behind the master, he saved me from middle class neurosis. Timothy did. At any rate, I always wanted to offer an audience consciousness as clear as I could get it. And so I was always in the bathroom or somewhere preparing to go on stage in a psychedelic way. And I was appearing at the Committee in San Francisco, which is a club. And I had been out to Half Moon Bay to prepare and had taken some LSD, but I mistimed it, so it peaked as people dressed me and put me out on stage. And I sat on the stool and I looked out at the audience and I saw ocean waves, and I didn't really know what I was doing there, and sort of, as Paul was pointing out, which level to come in on. So I said, are there any questions? And this large fish stood up. And he had a tie and a jacket on, and and he said, could you comment on the relative merits of serotonin, the synaptic theories of the hypothalamus? And it was this fish opening his mouth, and what he was saying was, do you love me? So he sat down, and I said to him, yes, I love you. Right? And he said, that doesn't satisfy me at all. After, I thought about all these anniversaries, and this is actually the 30th year anniversary of when I was first, when somebody extended compassion to me. I was a psychologist, psychotherapist, psychologist at Stanford, and a real tight-assed person. And I was, my first therapy patient saw my predicament, and he turned, he turned me on to grass, which was a, his name was Vic Lovell, and Ken Kesey dedicated One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to Vic, by the way, and that was a nice time for all of us. But then in 61, the major transformation of direction in my life occurred through really the compassion of Timothy, who introduced me to psilocybin. And it's interesting that since that time, whatever that experience was, when I touched the unconditioned mind, when I touched awareness behind my thoughts, when I realized I wasn't who I thought I was, and I breathed a tremendous sigh of relief. I mean, I had been so busy curring that model of who I thought I was and projecting it outward and getting a conspiracy to make believe I was that, that it was incredibly refreshing to find this very ancient place in myself where I am and I always was and always will be. It had nothing to do with life or death, or it just is. And I was in ecstasy, and I was rolling in the snow outside Timothy's home. And many of you probably know this story, that I then climbed through the snow to go back. I was spending the weekend at my parents' home, and it was around 4 in the morning, and there had been a big snowstorm, so I decided to shovel their walk. And I felt very much like the young member of the tribe, you know, doing his work. And my parents' faces appeared in the upstairs window, with the look of, you damn fool, what are you, drunk? It's the middle of the night. What are you doing shoveling snow? And I realized that that was the voice that had guided me to my PhD. And that was the one that always told me who I was supposed to be. And I looked inside with this new place, and I realized it was all right to shovel snow. And I waved at them and laughed. And that was like the first act of trying to integrate what had happened to me. I wasn't trying. I just integrated what had happened to me into my new social relationship. Well, for the past 25 years, I have done everything I could think of to integrate what happened to me in that moment under Timothy's guidance. And several years ago, I was with David McClelland, who was Tim's and my boss at Harvard. And David said to me, "You know, Dick, you haven't changed a bit." And I thought, after all this work, it was a complete delusion. But inside myself, as you all understand, that what you see, to turn it into what you be, is a really subtle and sensitive trip. That after the first moment of awakening, to try to integrate that into your life, to integrate the bad trips and the good trips, the horrible beauty of the universe, to integrate the level of awareness that exists behind form and play, as Christ said, in the world but not of the world, is it's such an incredibly subtle process. Because if you go too far one way, you kind of lose it, and if you go too far the other way, you lose it. I was looking back over a book in preparation for coming here tonight that I did with Sidney Cohen back in 1966. It was a book called LSD. And I came across a picture in that book. There were a set of pictures that we picked, and Sidney was the good guy, and I was the bad guy in the book. I was the guy that was advocating the use of psychedelics, and Sidney was the guy that was saying dangerous and stop. Tim was too bad, so I was the next baddest guy they could use. And Tim and Sidney picked all the pictures that showed people going, and I picked all the pictures of people playing flutes and making love and playing in fields with flowers. And there was only one picture both of us picked, of all the pictures. And it was a picture of a fellow lying on the kitchen floor looking at some spilled Coca-Cola. Now, Sidney picked it because it showed the trivial nature of the mind when it's drugged. But I knew that that fellow was seeing the entire universe in that bit of spilled Coca-Cola. I've noticed, because I'm a psychologist, somewhere back in there, one incarnation back, that in all the years that I went through psychoanalysis, became a therapist, took drugs, went to India, had a guru, have done Buddhist meditation, Hindu meditation, etc. In all that time, I haven't gotten rid of one neurosis. Right? Isn't that interesting? I mean, we thought, I know Tim and I really thought that the minute you saw it, you'd be, it would all be, you'd just be a liberated being. Not one neurosis have I gotten rid of. But I noticed that there's something that has changed. That the neuroses used to be these huge monsters. Like, no, don't do that. I mean, that sexual perversity. You know, don't take me over. And now they're sort of like little schmooze. And I kind of invite them for tea. Oh, sexual perversity. Come on in. I haven't seen you in months. You know, come on in. And that's part of the integrity of this experience, of growing into seeing the relative nature of reality. And the papier-mâché quality of social institutions. And the way in which personality turns into style rather than substance. It's interesting that I've ended up working so much with dying because it was really through Aldous and Alan and Tim and Ralph that I even got involved in that. You got to understand that the image that's been developed is that Timothy and I were really playing a heavy role at Harvard in visionary stuff. In fact, Timothy had the vision. I was like, I didn't understand what the hell he was doing, to tell you the truth. I was the one that constantly said, Timothy, you're going too fast. Timothy, slow down. And he did this psychedelic experience based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And the whole thing seemed absolutely nonsensical to me when he and Ralph did that. And it's interesting that it's taken me many years to grow into the kinds of visions that he was having in those days. And to appreciate how much what happened to me through psychedelics transformed my consciousness in such a way that death meant something different to me, that allowed me to be in the presence of somebody that was dying in a way that honored the drama of the process without getting lost in it. Okay. There was a study done, as most of you know, by Dr. Walter Pankey at Harvard for his doctorate in divinity. He was an MD, which was known as the Good Friday Study. It was an extraordinary study in which 20 theological students from the Andover Newton Theological Seminary participated in a double-blind placebo study on Good Friday in the Boston University Chapel. As a Harvard research project, we took three institutions down with us on that one. And half of the ministers in training were given psilocybin and half were given a placebo, as if we had to make believe that it was nothing, because that's the null hypothesis. And afterwards, they reported what had happened to them. And Walter had taken all of the criteria in the Bible of mystical experience. He found there were 9 criteria of a genuine mystical revelatory experience. And then he took these protocols from these 20 subjects, and he typed them up, taking all references to drugs out of them, and he sent them to major theologians around the country. And he asked them to judge these protocols in terms of these 9 criteria. Of the control group, 1 of the 10 had 1 of the 9 criteria. Of the experimental group that took the psilocybin, 9 of the 10 had 4 or more of the criteria of a genuine religious mystical experience. It was snidely reported in Time magazine under the title Instant Mysticism. But it turned out that that touched me very deeply. Because what had happened to me was that I had touched something that I couldn't find metaphors that I was comfortable with for dealing with it. And it's interesting that over the years, Timothy and Ralph and I have all gone in different directions, finding metaphors that were uniquely suitable to our karmic predicament to understand what the hell happened to us at that moment. And what happened to me was that it definitely, I experienced that as a link to all of the spiritual traditions. And it led me to India and to my guru and into Buddhism and so on, where I found these wonderful cartographers giving maps of just the processes that my mind was going through and my heart was going through. And many of you know that when I met my guru, he said, you use that medicine? I said, what medicine? He said, that medicine. And somebody said, maybe he means LSD. And I said, LSD? And he says, yeah, acha. Here's this old man sitting up in the mountains on a table. He says, you got any of it? Yeah. So I brought out the bottle, because I carried a little traveling case with me for moments when meditation wasn't enough. And I handed him one of Owsley's best. It was 300 micrograms. And he held out his hand for more. So I put a second one, that was 600 micrograms. He asked for another one, so I put 900 micrograms. And then he went like that. And the scientist in me thought, this is going to be very interesting. Because, and so I kept watching. And he had a lot of body weight, so I was computing how long the onset with the body weight and so on. And after an hour, nothing had happened. Well, it blew my mind. I mean, I had never met anybody that could take 900 micrograms and nothing happened. Because the implication of that was that he was in a place where, see, we took acid to go from point A to point B, but if you're already at point B, it's like drinking water. So I came home and I told everybody about it, but in my mind was this little gnawing feeling that maybe he just clouded my mind and threw it over his shoulder, because I didn't actually see it go into the mouth, you see. So I came back to India in 1971, and he called me up to him one day. And he said, did you give me some medicine when you were here last time? I said, yes. He said, did I take it? I said, I think so. He said, what happened? I said, nothing. He says, go away. Ciao. Then he called me up the next day. He says, you got any more? I said, yeah. So I brought it out, and I had five pills, one of which was broken. So he took four of them. This was 1,200 micrograms. And he took each one, and he stuck a tongue. He put on... The next one, next one, next one. Because he knew. And then he said, can I take water? And I said, sure. He says, garam, pani, hot or cold? I said, whatever you want. He called for water. He drank a glass of water. He said, will it make me crazy? I said, probably. And after a while, and he said, how long will it take? So I said, maybe an hour. So he called a man over with a big watch, and he was holding the watch, looking at it, saying. And after a little while, he went under his blanket, and he came up looking absolutely mad. I mean, like, you know? And I thought, what have I done? This old man is 80 years old, and I've given him acid, and he didn't realize how strong our medicines are, and he took it, and oh, my God, what have I done? I'll never live with my ethical breach, and, you know. And then he just laughed at me. And he said, these were known about thousands of years ago. Yogis used these. But he says they don't now do the purification, so it doesn't work the same way. He said, it's useful. I said, should I take it anymore? He said, if you're in a cool place and you're feeling much peace and your mind is turned towards God, he said, it could be useful. He said, it would allow you to come in and have the darshan of the Spirit, come in and be in the presence of the Spirit. But he says, you can only stay 2 hours. He said, it would be better to become the Spirit than just visit it. But he said, your medicine won't do that. And I appreciate that. I really appreciate the message of that. It's like Houston Smith, who Tim referred to. He said, LSD produces religious experiences, but it's less evident whether it can produce a religious life. And what I have experienced in the past 25 years is, if I were to look at what the essence of the matter is that having touched the unconditioned and having seen the relative nature of reality and the way the mind creates the dream, that has given me a faith in the possibility of who we are. And that faith has been what has guided me from method to method and was allowed me to use the methods because I understood the possibility, even though often it was just a memory of something that had happened to me. And it feels to me that as long as I live, I will still be growing into what happened to me on the first psychedelic experience. That it's just a process we go through of slowly tuning and tuning. And for the first 10 years, I can't see, can I have a couple, just a couple more minutes? Yeah. We're supposed to stop at 11. I mean, we got to give the place back, but... For the first 10 years, I understood that the game was to get high. And what it involved fit in right very clearly with my own neurosis, which was a rejection of my own humanity. I mean, I really fit into a renunciate path. And so what I was a horny celibate for years. I won't think about sex. I won't think about sex. It's obsessed with it. And I pushed everything, all the human stuff away, because I just wanted to get out there and stay there for the good of everybody in my mind. And somewhere along the way, I began to see that what that wisdom showed me was that if you push away anything, it's got you. That pushing away my humanity was as much attachment. I remember being with Alan Watts once at a Benedictine monastery we were working at. We were in his room partaking of the altar wine at around 2 a.m. And he said to me, Dick, your problem is you're too attached to emptiness. And he was right on. He was right on. As the third patriarch says, even to be attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray. And what's happened to me from the past 10, 12, 14 years is a coming back into my humanity. It's as if once I rooted myself in the awareness that exists behind form, even a little bit, and I'm just a little way along the path, that faith allowed me then to come and dip back into the world of forms and allow my heart to be open, like keeping your heart open in hell, keeping your heart open in the presence of suffering, because even at the moment when the suffering is most intense, right behind it inside you is an incredible equanimity. Because one of the things that I touched through acid was an extreme appreciation of the perfection of the laws of form, the perfection of the unfolding of the law. And it sounds like it's too hard to lay on the world that suffering is great. But I can feel, when I look at what our spiritual journeys are on this plane, it feels so obvious to me that the stuff we are handed is the grist for the mill of awakening out of the illusion until we can be in the form without being entrapped by it, so that we can play lightly, we can dance sweetly, we can have joy in the presence of the hell realms and do what we can do to relieve the suffering without getting burned out and lost and bitter and cynical and frustrated. And we can... and we have the tolerance to deal with chaos and uncertainty. And what has happened is that the 60s unleashed something extraordinarily powerful that is still reverberating and echoing in this culture and actually in the world. And what that released was a recognition in people that they were free to change institutions and themselves. And each of us is figuring out how to do that. But social institutions which have power structures are very threatened by that kind of change. And what we are coming to appreciate is the way in which we can go about changing in such a way that the transformations are gentle, that they aren't necessarily violent. When Gandhi said, "I want the British to leave, but I want them to leave as friends," it was our, once we saw the vision, we so wanted to manifest the vision in form, and there was so much confusion between the evolutionary process and the revolutionary process, that a lot of what we did in setting up alternative structures, in the way in which we protested, created more and more polarity in this culture. And in an interesting way, Ronald Reagan has been in power because of what we did in the 60s. We gave that power to him. That's a very interesting phenomenon. And it's only as we get to see behind the pendulum swings of revolution and really acknowledge the fact there has been true evolution, can we learn how to just transform the social institutions by understanding that the same institutions can work very differently when they're motivated by love rather than motivated by fear. So this was just a progress report of what's happened to me 30 years down the road. I'll be back in 10 more years to give you another one. Thank you.